the youth forum, we particularly felt that the threat of the solutions related to climate change in the Bengal region is a very important topic to cover, especially as people gather from all over the country to celebrate many aspects of the Bengali culture, as well as the truths and the possibilities for what's happening in the region, and especially that tie into the next generation. So I'd like to start by thanking Anirban Chatterjee, who first proposed this topic that we do this. And of course, thanks to our panelists who have come to join us today for this particular session. I distributed the quick flyer for this topic. They're both great speakers and leaders of their own right, and didn't want to take too much time with the bio and the introduction so we can hear their good talk. Real quickly, we selected both of them. Professor Ishare, who is with the UC Berkeley, will cover mostly sort of the science and the threat and the solutions of global warming in the region. And then Anamulin Tan will cover sort of the social, political, socio-political aspects of climate change and what's really happening in that region and what can people do. The underlying theme, of course, is action, so to speak. We've talked amongst ourselves. The reason why we want to have these discussions today is hopefully walk away with a few realizations or action items we could take in our individual lives, given our profession, what we do, what we would like to learn more, and how we might choose to connect to people on this topic. Of course, we'll solve problems in this particular gathering, but I request you to keep that end goal in mind as you hear their fine presentations. So with that, Anandu, would you like to go first, the professor?
I think we decided that we would be
okay, of course.
So, all right. So thank you everybody for being here today.
Thanks, Anandu.
So I'd like to briefly introduce the main ideas or the main threats that global warming poses to the Bengal region. These are, of course, very similar to threats that it poses elsewhere, but I'm going to identify the Bengal region specifically in terms of two particular threat points. And then we're going to discuss briefly some of the solutions, particularly with the view to us being the diasporic community, because there are certain solutions that we cannot possibly engage in and others that are more viable for us. So I'm going to focus on those. And then that will segue into Anandu's talk, which will be more about action and what the community should be doing. So the outline of my talk is, very briefly, what is anthropogenic global warming? What are its main impacts likely to be in South Asia over a 2 to 3 decade period? What will be the impact on West Bengal and Bangladesh from these two issues, particularly glacier melt and sea level rise? Then I will briefly touch upon the issue of North-South equity, because it has divided the community of activists and practitioners on the global warming issue. And then, as Lennon has said, what is to be done? So, anthropogenic global warming is the rise in and the projected continuation of, okay? The rise in and continuation of, I wanted to put that down. Because if emissions of all global warming gases went to zero tomorrow, the world would still continue to warm because of the lag effect for many centuries, okay? So we are looking at the rise in and projected continuation of the Earth's temperature, surface air and ocean, mostly the heat is trapped in the oceans, since the middle of the 20th century, mostly due to human-driven activity, such as burning fossil fuels and deforestation, and this definition is from IPCC's fourth assessment report. So we're talking about a rise in temperature globally, driven by human activities. What is the impact of such a rise, the projected rise, on South Asia in the next 2 to 3 decade period? Okay. So the four major threats and impacts that we see are more floods, more drought, and more extreme weather events, primarily from glacial melt in the Himalayas, and I will touch upon glacial melt in a couple of moments. Crop yields are projected to decline by about 30% because of a combination of glacial melt and temperature rise. higher mortality is predicted from diarrhea and other waterborne diseases, both because of the scarcity of water and because of the worsening quality of that water which we have. And finally, from sea level rise, major inundation, erosion, and potential displacement, okay, because the coastal areas are likely to get washed out. So these are the four primary impacts, big impacts, that the World Bank projects for South Asia over the next three-decade period. This is a very important map for us because it shows us the globe and its tipping points, meaning what aspect of climate change is that part of the world most vulnerable to, right? So here you can look at the South Asia region, and it actually says Indian monsoon climatic instability. So it's the instability I want to focus on. And why do I want to focus on instability? Instability is essentially the worst thing for the globe's poor. Difficulty, well, they've coped with it most of their lives. Poverty, what can I say? Instability requires resources to cope with unpredictability, uncertainty, insurance, not knowing what is going to happen tomorrow. This is very hard for most of us, but it's exceptionally hard for the poor because there is no fallback. There is no fallback, okay? So if we actually knew what climate change was going to do by way of water availability, maybe we could plan for it. But the most important thing we know about climate change is highly uncertain, unpredictable, extreme events are likely to take place with greater frequency. And this is essentially the worst thing that can happen for the poor, okay? So what does this mean for South Asia's poor? Less water and worse water. There can be essentially no doubt about that. We are already seeing it. So this is not a 2 to 3 decade problem, really. It's tomorrow's problem. Unreliable hydroelectric and biomass production because of unreliability of flows of water. Hydroelectric production as well as crop production obviously depends on reliable streams of water. Okay, unreliability is a killer. Fish catch declines, naturally. If the water goes down and it becomes of lousy quality, the fish will die off. And you know that fish provides 12 to 15% of the protein of the Bengali coastal areas. Hunger, no surprises there, following cleanly from 1, 2, and 3. More deaths from malaria and diarrhea. I would like to point out that the South Asian region is already home to most children dying from diarrhea under the age of 5. This can only be exacerbated. And finally, massive human displacement, because if large parts of the coastal area actually get washed out, where will these millions of people go? They have to go somewhere. Where? We really don't know. We really haven't brought our minds to cope, so to speak, with the scale of the problem that we're likely to face. So in short, if we don't actually do anything, if business as usual continues, then we are essentially facing, that region is facing multidimensional disaster by the middle of the 20th century, which is closer than we think. And now I'd like to move on to two specific impacts on West Bengal and Bangladesh. First, the glacier melt. First, we'll talk about glacier melt. There are multiple glaciers in the Himalayas. One of the largest is the Gangotri, from which the Brahmaputra and Ganga both draw their waters. And I would like to show you in this photograph the retreat of the glacier. This is from USGS, US Geological Service photographs that they have been tracking, also from London, because in 1780 there was obviously no USGS. Okay, so they're tracking the retreat of the glacier, the Gangotri Glacier, which feeds the Ganga and the Brahmaputra. Can you see how it is going further and further back? Here's my cursor. 1780 is the first point. Okay? Here is 1935. These are photographs taken by people who used to go up to the Everest and so on. And they could see where the glacier line was. Now you can see 1971. Can you see the 1971 point is here? Between 1971 and 2001, there are how many years? Look at the sharp decline between 1971 and 2001. So essentially, this is now the snow line. And 30 years ago, that was the snow line. Right? 1964, that was the snow line. This is pretty much our lifetimes, well, most of us anyway. Right? So this is what is happening. What does this, why does this matter? Why does this matter? It matters because, as Sir Nicholas Stern has said, precipitation comes, rain comes, and it's held there. He means it's held in the Himalayas. What does he mean by it's held? It's held like storage, as snow. Right? That's what it's doing. Those are our reserves. That snow is my reserve. Okay? So it's held as a reserve. That is how you get water in the river. That damn thing melts and comes down, inundates the Ganga and the Brahmaputra plains, and makes it possible to grow two seasons of rice paddy. Right? That is the importance of the Himalayas. Okay? That effect, that storage effect, he means, will not be there if the glaciers and snow are not there, which means you will get torrents during the wet season and dry rivers in the dry season, exactly the reverse of what you would like. Right? Okay. 1 billion people are directly fed by the waters from the Himalayan snowmelt. And these are the projected crop yield declines in South Asia on account of that retreating glacier line. As you can see, every crop is projected to have a yield decline. In particular, some of the major crops, millet, maize, rice, and wheat, are all projected to have declines. And the mean has shifted left. Average declines will fall, and the error bars are also larger in some cases. So now let's go to projected sea level rise, the second thing that is likely very highly to threaten the Bengal region. The line that you see, the horizontal zero line, is the ocean temperature at 1990. So I'm holding the ocean temperature at 1990 constant in this graph. Is that clear? I'm pretending the ocean will not become hotter. Now that is false, but I'm just pretending for now that the ocean will not become hotter. Okay, if that is the case, here is 1990, 1995, these are projections, okay? So the real impact was closer to the this blue dashed line. So there's always uncertainty in the prediction. There are low ranges and there are high ranges. And as we go further, we are seeing a large range of prediction because these models are still highly uncertain, but the mean is not looking good, right? These are the mean from the the IPCC, essentially the most common scientifically cited. So projected sea level rise basically means this level of sea level rise is projecting that by 2100, 90 to 100 centimeters of sea will have risen, which is essentially a 1 meter rise in the mean sea level. Now, that is, if it rises by 1 meter. If it rises, means that nothing is done. 15% of Bangladesh will be inundated because a large part of Bangladesh is only 5 meters above sea level today. Any storm that comes to Bangladesh already inundates a good part of its coastland, including, this happens in the West Bengal Sundarbans also. With another meter sea level rise, a major storm beyond that will mean the sea will rise by 2 to 3 meters. That is like the tsunami that hit South Asia in 2004. Okay, so by 2100, we're expecting, if nothing happens, which I'm confident that that won't be the case, but, well, I'm sort of confident that won't be the case, okay, that we're looking at a worst case scenario, 15% inundation of Bangladesh and 75% of West Bengal's mangrove region. So now we'll go to the issue of North-South equity. One of the things that has driven, you know, people in India and China to be separate from others, and even within India and China, within Bangladesh, there's been a big debate. We have not caused the problem, the argument goes. Why should we take a hit in our development plans and aspirations because of the problems of the North? And one of the starkest ways to show the current global inequity is this picture. This is the night earth. This is called the picture of the night earth. You can see that the better off parts of the world are blazing with lights, right? Now look at Latin America and Africa. You can leave aside Australia because it is largely unpopulated. Okay, they don't really have an electricity problem. But the picture of India is quite interesting because 20 years ago, India was darker than it is now. This same photograph of India has changed. So you can see, though, the global inequity in the electricity that they're able to use at night, for example, which electricity is largely fueled by fossil fuels, coal, gas, and so on, oil, right? So the issue, why should I pay for your mistakes? So I want to make my position completely clear. There is no point in my babbling about your mistakes. The problem is mine now. Right? The crisis is all about us. You have to, if we do not fully participate in the formulation of solutions, because we decide, well, India and China and Bangladesh should just belt ahead for the next 50 years, and we should just reach exactly the same lifestyle and the same style of life as the US has, because we have a right to do this. You change for us. This may become politically an untenable situation, and it will prevent us from participating fully in the formulation of solutions which do not replicate the past inequities. Because we have to be fully engaged in the formulation of future equitable solutions. And I'll come to some of them in a moment. The fairness principle, the UNFCCC has decided, that's the climate change group, already demands more payment and sacrifice from the more capable. Equity and fairness demands that. I think that it would be a strategic error for those of us in South Asia to add or take up substantial amounts of time on the blame game now. That is my personal position. I'll now move to what is to be done, particularly by the diasporic population. So I've identified four or five issues that we should be thinking about as we go forward. One, it's really critical for those of us in the elite part of the South Asian community, world, and every part of this world to opt for energy efficiency and push politically for energy efficiency solutions whenever possible. This energy is the largest, production of energy and the use of energy is the largest emitter of global warming gases. Bar none, this graph shows that the cost of abatement, meaning if you actually opt for efficiency-oriented solutions in everything, that is actually cheaper, okay? Cheaper than opting for the non-efficient solutions that we typically go for, that are still the norm. So it's really important for us to be thinking about insulation, air conditioning, lighting, water heating, fuel efficiency, vehicle efficiency. All of these add up in the most astonishing way to the use of more oil, gas, and coal. So it's very important to bear these in mind and to push for them in our city plans, in our country plans, wherever we have influence. It is very important to consider our food habits. Okay? Next to electricity production, the largest emitter of, and transportation, the largest emitter of global greenhouse gases is agriculture. And chief amongst agriculture is meat production. Meat production alone contributes almost a fifth of all global GHGs. Isn't that amazing? Meat production just contributes 20% of global GHGs. And who thinks about that? Okay? So how much attention are we, the elite, paying to our food habits? Three, we have to support adaptation. A lot of effort goes into mitigation. How can we prevent? What we don't want to think about is how can we cope with the unpreventable? But not thinking about coping with the unpreventable, not going to make the unpreventable go away. Adaptation is the most understudied aspect of climate change politics and economics. Migration policies, financing, land use transformation, rice research to make rice possible to grow in drought conditions and so on, are really, really have to be pursued on a global scale. And whatever you can do to support that, participate in it, finance it, push for financing is greatly needed. Because many millions of people's lives are already at stake, remember, even if global emissions go to zero tomorrow, which they will not. Think when you act. Do my, we all say action, action. Do my actions scale or are they making me feel good? Please don't come to me with a t-shirt saying I support global warming, of which 0.5% of the profits has gone to some worthy company. No, you know, it's going to do diddy squat. Alright? It's fine to be consistent in your life, but you really have to know what is called upon us as a community. Okay? Demand the inconvenient truth. And the inconvenient truth demands not only our personal little sacrifices, because they're only small actions, but it demands mobilization and organization. Because you can't wear a t-shirt or drink green coffee and think that's okay. And what do I mean by organization and why? One, decarbonizing the energy economy and going for adaptation measures and lower consumption really is going to call for concerted and highly political action at every level. It will not call for my saying, "Acha kalke theke ami mangsho khawa chhere dicchi." You know, I know my friends, I say, "Bhalo, tamadir to beshi korche, tu phala ta kha." I know how to do it, right? That's not going to go anywhere, okay? Must work as a diasporic community influence priorities back home. The diasporic community has a lot of influence in India, in Bangladesh, and in places where we come from. Okay? Possibly it is unwarranted influence, but I would say it's time to use it. Three, must work as concerned global citizens to have equitable distribution of future GHG emissions. There has to be some way that the world will come to a conclusion on how much future GHG emissions will be permitted by country or by person. Okay? And it has to be equitably done. I would support an equal per capita, but it's something to think about and lobby on and work on. And the reason the organization is so important is because little personal choices without mobilization will take forever, and we don't actually have forever. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Hold your questions. We're going to hear Mr. Tan's presentation, and then we're going to have a combination Q&A because his presentation will complement what Professor Ray just said.
Well, thank you, Professor Ray. That's I couldn't have asked for a better, you know, framing of the situation. And just before I get started, I wanted to test a couple of things in this room because I know that a lot of what Professor Ray has covered, it can be very complex, can be very technical, but global warming being as it is on the top of, you know, people's, you know, in the spotlight, so to speak, I'm assuming that most of us are familiar with these issues. How many folks here, with a simple raise of hands, feel like you have a strong understanding of global warming and the greenhouse gas effect?
Define strong.
Well, as long as you're familiar with those terms, I think that's good. The other thing I wanted to ask, because I think the last part of Professor Ray's presentation, which I found most inspiring, was where I find most common cause is the call to organize. And I think that's what I'm going to try to focus a lot of my presentation on, is what is the moral imperative for this diaspora to actively organize. So a question to all of you, how many of you are familiar with any history of organizing in your family? Grandparents or parents who were involved in the independence movement or in any other political organizing? And as I would have expected. So my discussion, and you have to please forgive me, I'm not going to be as sharp or as tight as Professor Ray's presentation. I spent a lot of time thinking, how do I actually speak to the moral imperative? Where is climate justice activism relevant to the Bengali diaspora? And how do we link this back to both our affinity with our fellow Bengalis at home, but also with our understanding of a universal responsibility, the identity of a universal being, which we have the privilege to really have been gifted by many of our literary giants and political thought leaders in our history. Speaking of thought leaders, my mother advised me a few weeks ago, well, you should actually have another look at certain books by Tagore, specifically Kodali Prakriti, and this particular essay, The Robbery of the Soil. And going through The Robbery of the Soil, it was interesting to see how forward-thinking Tagore was in his time in terms of identifying how inequity was really leading us towards some of the biggest ecological disasters of our time. And so with that, with Tagore's quote, I thought it would be appropriate to start off this presentation. So I won't even dwell on this, since so many of you know are familiar with the greenhouse gas effect. And as Professor Ray explained, global warming, it has been proven beyond the shadow of a doubt, with the last fourth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the largest consensus of scientists in the history, in human history, to have incensed on the fact that global warming is man-made, primarily caused by the release of greenhouse gases from the wide range of industrial activity and consumer activity, predominantly in industrial activity, that's happened in the last 100 years with the advent and sudden growth of fossil fuel-centered economies and industrial development. What I do largely in my line of work, which is really looking at how does civil society, how do communities, how do individual activists tackle and organize around climate change, we start off with looking at what are the root causes. So we mentioned anthropogenic greenhouse gases. So what are the primary industries that are responsible for greenhouse gas emissions? As Professor Ray mentioned, electricity production, power generation is perhaps the single largest industrial sector, amounting to about 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions, here in the US hovering around 34-35%. But from coal, liquid natural gas, and all kinds of other fossil fuel power generation, that's where we get most of our CO2 emissions. Then of course the oil refineries, which produce our car-driven culture, which account for another 30%, especially in the north, greenhouse gas emissions. And finally, of course, land use change, agriculture. This is a picture of forest destruction in the Amazon, forest that was specifically cut down to grow soya, that actually goes to explain the larger cycle of meat production. Because as we know, most of that soya isn't grown to feed humans, it's grown to it's grown as animal feed. Sold in Europe, in China, and elsewhere in the world, where there's this massive growth of factory farming going on. And of course, power generation, predominant amount of power generation is taken up by our urban centers, some of the most privileged parts in the most privileged parts of this world. And of course, it doesn't matter what color you paint it, it remains a Hummer. We talked about factory farming recently, I learned, and I came across this picture. I hadn't realized that how much factory farming had grown in India in recent years. And I was shown some interesting statistics how in the rapidly developing nations of Brazil, India, and China, their meat consumption is rapidly approaching the levels of meat consumption here in the US. So once we've identified the root causes, what next? Assessing what is a whole, where do we intervene becomes a big question. Can one intervene right at the point of electricity production or the point of oil production? Or does one have to go back a bit further and look at the larger industrial flows, right from mining and extraction to end use? And so in terms of other impacts beyond of climate change, what we've started to recognize as other human impacts are the impacts on the full cycle, or the full life cycle of destructive greenhouse gas intensive industries. So in this case, the mining of the tar sands, the most rapidly growing source of US oil coming from the tar sands in Canada, just ends up destroying thousands and thousands of square miles of virgin boreal forest. Also, indigenous territories where traditional people still rely on hunting and gathering for subsistence. This is a picture in the background of mountaintop removal mining, some of you may have heard of, where entire mountaintops are blown up to extract coal seams from some of the last remaining coal seams in the Appalachian Mountains in the U.S. Southeast. And of course, and some of the fallout of both mountaintop removal mining and tar sands mining is massive sludge reservoirs that are created, heavily toxic for ecosystems, but also for humans living, communities living around there, for indigenous communities up in the tar sands, and communities live here in the United States. Oftentimes, while we address north-south equity issues, we forget to address the equity issues within in our own backyard. predominantly the people living on the front lines of these kind of impacts, whether it's coal mining, tar sands mining, sludge reservoirs, or toxic emissions from coal power plants, are working class, poor people, people of color, African American people, Mexican American people, basically the most vulnerable people in the North American populace. This particular picture may be of some interest. That's an elementary school, and it sits at the foot of a massive sludge reservoir right behind it. It's become a hotspot of a lot of recent media attention because there's 200 kids that go to that school that could, you know, with any small accident be, you know, sort of just flooded over with this toxic sludge that is growing in the hill behind, in the hillside reservoir behind them. And of course, we're all familiar with the actual impacts, which I think put climate change on the map finally here in the US with Katrina and all the human victims of that catastrophe. So climate justice, it's a term that has been used a lot to address the human side, the human face of all these impacts. And one way I've heard climate justice encapsulated is it is a vision of a future when we where we address inequity, the inequity in society that leads to this kind of ecological and human destruction, inequity that leads to the unequal burdens of climate impacts from cradle to grave, the fact that it's the poorest, the most vulnerable that are impacted from the extraction of fossil fuels, right through to the final impacts of the low-lying island states, the poor fishing villages living on the coastlines of some of the most vulnerable nation states. And also the vision is a forward-thinking vision of how, when we look at shifting or trying to stabilize the climate, how do we create a new energy economy that is fair and equitable for all? So this really embodies the whole notion of climate justice. Currently, the people who use the least power in modern industrial society, both here in the North and in the Global South, are people who are on the front lines of climate change, are people who are faced with the heaviest impacts. So the unfairness of that, I think, strikes everyone. The fact that people who are least responsible for climate change are going to be the first to suffer. And the billion people, they estimate a billion climate refugees on our current trajectory of greenhouse gas emissions and global warming, if we keep continuing, the first billion climate refugees by the end of this century will all mostly be people who do not even have proper access to electricity. So that is something that jumps out to most activists. And it makes you ponder whether the first tier strategy to addressing climate change is addressing the inequity issue, addressing how can we create sustainable power usage and sustainable development for the most vulnerable as a first tier strategy. Perhaps even before looking at how do the rest of us reduce our consumption. And like I said, in the global debate, oftentimes the people who are forgotten are the poor, the working poor in the North, who, interestingly enough, currently have less of a voice in the UN in the international negotiations than a lot of southern groups that are very well represented by strong civil society groups addressing the equity issue. A few principles that have been used to define how to guide a framework for climate justice are worth mentioning. First of course, stop cooking the pot. A simple one. It's something that's basically the backbone of dealing with climate change. Protect and empower those who are most vulnerable. And the empower part is really important because later on we'll get to this, but the fact that the frontline communities, the people who are most impacted by climate change, may have a say in the design of their future, or the design of a new energy economy, or what energy systems are appropriate for their communities is really critical as a tier one justice strategy. Ensuring just transition. This is something you may have heard about in the news a lot lately, about stimulus funds to buffer the economic crisis, but also climate stimulus funds. How do we create green jobs, jobs that will carry us into the a new energy economy, and ensure that people working in industries like coal power generation, in oil refineries, actually can get retrained and have a fair chance of getting a good job in a new sustainable field of production. How do those benefits in a new energy economy get shared more equitably than the status quo? That's a key premise of justice-based approach. And like I said earlier, how do we actually engage those communities most affected in our democratic decision-making process that may require a whole reorientation of our approach to how we design new energy systems? This is something that then becomes really relevant. While we recognize that the problems are of global scale and there is a global collective responsibility, when we actually seek those sustainability answers, what we find is the locally designed, locally appropriate solutions are oftentimes the best, the first steps to take. And by testing locally appropriate solutions, we can then collaborate internationally to ensure that there's a global strategy with regionally appropriate design. And actually, one of the pioneers of appropriate solutions was a gentleman named Amundo Reddy from South India, who really looked at how do we incorporate locally appropriate designs that would use local resources that Indian farmers and rural communities could implement with very low cost, because that's another big component. Finally, the precautionary principle, which is essentially embodies the fact that where we do not know, where we do not fully understand the effects of any new technology, we should take a precautionary approach. We should step back and favor to research and understand it before actually implementing any new technology, whether it be in terms of new fuels, new technologies for power generation, or new products in the marketplace. This is a principle that is very intertwined with justice. And finally, of course, the ultimate justice principle is intergenerational justice. Our ultimate goal is how can we ensure that we're not taking care of our energy needs for tomorrow, but we're saving a planet for future generations to come, for our grandchildren. So I'll go back to the politics of equity a bit, and dwell on this a bit. What is happening internationally right now in the UN negotiations is trying to figure out how to carve up responsibilities around dealing with climate change. And how do we address the issue of who's responsible for what portion of greenhouse gas emissions reductions, or what portion of the cost of sustainable development? These are all issues that are being discussed at the UN Framework Convention for Climate Change. And these negotiations, of course, are based on the premise that governments somehow can chalk out, you know, the commons, the atmospheric commons, to say we're going to be responsible for the price of dealing with the atmospheric commons in different ways. Which brings an interesting question: is that if it is a global commons, then do we all individually and as communities have a certain cost to bear, and also do we have a certain stake, a financial stake, in the sky? And that leads us back to the question of, well, ultimately, when we divvy up those responsibilities, do the northern nations have a lion's share of responsibility for the commons that they have polluted for the most part? So, having taken up so much of the atmospheric commons with their greenhouse gas emissions, there's a responsibility to ensure that that poorer nations can continue developing, but can be subsidized for the cost of clean development from the pockets and purses of the biggest polluters. At any point, if something is unclear, please feel free to raise your hand and bring it to my notice. So I'll please do this a bit. So climate policy, as you can imagine, runs into a lot of issues around the development agenda. How do we develop sustainably so that we ensure that existing inequity is addressed without depending on status quo means of energy generation and status quo industrial production? The issue of I'm Freddie Neeland. He's kind of Well, these are just some graphs which actually show the that show some of the chart out some of the portions of responsibility. And quite oftentimes here in the US, especially from the US right, you hear, well, China's greenhouse gas emissions have exceeded the US, but it's quite often, as most of us are probably aware, it's from a total ignorance of the accounting that addresses the per capita amounts of emissions. When you look at the 1 billion people or 2 billion people that the biggest populations on this planet have to deal with and have to feed and house, the U.S. still comes up being considerably more consumptive and wasteful in terms of energy and greenhouse gas emissions than the rest of the world. I believe the U.S. On a per capita basis is responsible for about 25% of the atmospheric commons in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And the costs, again, are debated widely by different bodies, from NGOs to different UN agencies, depending on how they approach and what metrics they use. Ultimately, what's clear is that it's going to be a huge cost, and that cost has to come from somewhere. Hence, in terms of international climate policy, and again, I'll breeze through this very quickly, I can talk to folks later about it, the Kyoto Protocol and clean development mechanisms were designed so that the biggest polluters could help to fund clean development pathways for the global south. In terms of national climate policy, that the onus of greenhouse gas emissions reductions has fallen on every state, but in the north, anywhere from 70 to 90% emissions reductions targets have been expected of the biggest polluters. We're aware that currently this debate is raging in Congress and really narrowly passing votes through as the climate policy goes through Congress for a number of different reasons, and we can get into it later on. What role do corporations play? Well, corporations, as a fundamental approach to climate change, really look at mitigating cost and risk. Cost to status quo business, mitigating any risk associated with carbon intensity in their industries. And so they've also embraced, and some would say they have created, this whole carbon trading mechanisms, which the clean development mechanisms and the Kyoto Protocol is based on, to mitigate their own profits and mitigate impacts to their business. So you've heard of carbon offsets. So choosing to invest in development abroad to offset any emissions that are over limits that have been placed on industrial emissions for the North. Clean technologies, developing clean technologies both to mitigate emissions at home but also to provide in terms of technology transfer to the South. Finally, shaping policy. Corporations have a big stake in shaping policy, and this is probably a different presentation and something that climate justice has to contend with, the role of corporations in influencing national policy and sometimes at the cost of certain justice-based approaches. False solutions is something that we deal with quite often. When we talk about technologies, are all the technologies that are being put on the table real solutions? Does nuclear really address climate change? People who are embedded in climate change activism from a justice perspective would say not, because the cost is too high, the burden on communities is too high, and ultimately it's not a form of energy that communities can have any domain around. They're highly centralized, highly costly, and pose risks of their own that may even outweigh some of the greenhouse gas emissions risks. Are biofuels viable solutions? People like the International Peasants Movement would say no. let's say, interferes with the cost of food, interferes with the production of food, and really, recently the Food and Agriculture Organization had to acknowledge that was a major driver behind the recent international food crisis. Similarly, garbage burning, that's a garbage burner from somewhere in the eastern states. Some people are touting that as a green technology, but really, when you look at it, can you burn garbage sustainably? And common sense would dictate no. Recent findings would say that actually these are more greenhouse gas intensive technologies than coal. And of course, coal itself, speaking of coal, is trying to market itself as clean coal. We hear the term clean coal often, and I won't dwell on that, but I'd be happy to talk about it at a later time. Getting back to civil society and moral imperative. Dr. Ray spoke about this a bit. Is it enough? Many civil society groups are really still trying to push consumers to embrace practices like energy efficiency practices, buying hybrid cars, buying energy efficient appliances, shopping at the farmers markets, recycling, going back to other forms of more toxic free forms of transportation. They all have a cumulative effect, definitely, and they play an important role. But yes, I work mostly with groups that would say there's a much bigger role for all of us to play, and that is in collective action, taking it beyond the individual choice, consumer habits, to collective action. Collective action from creating urban gardens. I heard a very interesting story about a Vietnamese community in New Orleans recently, that they were able to adapt to the impacts of Hurricane Katrina better than any other immigrant community in poorer sections of New Orleans, because they had started urban gardens. And those urban gardens generated food at a time when food wasn't coming into their communities. So this is something that can be done immediately, and can be done as an adaptation measure. It really is also a measure of collective empowerment, public transportation, planting trees. This one comes up all the time. How important is planting trees? Well, again, it's a long conversation, but I say, in terms of deforestation playing a big role, climate change, it's something that can be collectively organized for a greater good. Finally, does anyone recognize what that picture is up there?
Harness?
Close.
Google Glass Plant.
Yeah. Google Glass Plant, exactly. One of actually Dr. Amulno Reddy's brilliant creations, which is perhaps one of the few forms of fuel burning that really is considered sustainable or closed loop, where it provides both gas for communities locally, but also manure at the end of it, fertilizer. I talked earlier about corporations. A lot of civil society groups are focused on putting forward alternative policy frameworks, and this is where a lot of energy goes. And a big question. So I'll wrap this up. A big question comes that takes place in my circles is, can civil society really lobby politicians for a just resolution? And I would say that these cards are stacked against us, because gentlemen like these, I was going to ask, which of these do you think is a member of a big environmental organization? It doesn't really matter, because they're all part of a group called the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which represents big oil, big coal, big oil, big utility companies, and a couple of big environmental groups who design U.S. climate policy. Finally, the kind of collective action that I engage in involves really challenging the root causes, whether it's in the global south, on the front lines of climate change, that's from Howard, by the way, or whether it is really going after the root causes, really going to addressing the decision makers, the politicians, the utility companies, the banks that finance these dirty energy sectors. And of course, more directly, actually intervening at those points of destruction, where people, are building a mass movement to ensure that we can eventually bring about the change that's required. I'll end off with I was going to say that there's a moral imperative for all of us, because what we are facing is a new form of colonialism. Mm-hmm. And really, that's where we make the link. A lot of people call it carbon colonialism, but it's not much unlike the colonialism that our forefathers fought against in their day. It's only that it's a global colonialism. The roots of that colonialism are the same, in creating inequity, in creating injustice in this world. And I can only say that in doing so, I think we should be positive and have faith that humanity will persevere. And as more of our friends and more of our families join in collectively, we can turn that new chapter in history and bring about, you know, that same safe place for our future generations.
Thank you for the thoughtful and very informative presentation. He actually ended up covering a lot. Key themes that merged up, think globally, act locally. In terms of individual actions can make a lot of difference, but we also have to have certain influences at the policy level, so the individual actions account to something that politically carries on, so to speak. So we hear this in our professions, those of us who are in environmental action and sustainability, that it's always a combination approach. It's not one or the other. It's various tools that have to go into that basket of solutions, so to speak, whether you're thinking at the policy level, the social level, individual action or not. I think we have to cover at least 3 or 4 questions. Thank you so much for your patience. We started a couple of minutes late, so I am going to steal that from the next session with your permission. I would cede that question is, since people need to walk away with some sense of how this may relate to what they do now, if you could think about that. Because most of us are already in a career. And some of you are actually thinking about which career to go into. Tying all these possible solutions into how it relates to your life and the choices we make professionally, academically, and personally is really important. So if we could cover those items in these questions to focus the discussion, I think we would gain a lot. So thanks again for coming, and please, we'll take about 3 questions. You first.
First thing, I talk with your lecture that show a global gas plant, that's a flop, both India and China. We used to